It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Good morning again, Casey.
Hey, good morning, Kirk.
It's been another week.
It has been another week, and it's been another incident of... Unfortunately, a public official was cited for OWI and hit and run. This time it happens to be the Racine County District Attorney, who was cited for drunk driving and leaving the scene of an accident this past Friday night, not this Friday night, but the one before, after striking a traffic light near his home. This was reported by the Journal Times. Officers were called to the intersection of Melvin Avenue and North Main Street just after 10 p.m. Friday in response to a single vehicle accident in which a car had apparently struck both a tree and a traffic signal. Responding officers located an unoccupied 2004 Volkswagen on scene. When officers arrived at the home of the vehicle's registered owner, it was discovered that the Racine County District Attorney had been the operator of that vehicle at the time of the incident, at least according to the police reports. He was then arrested for operating while intoxicated first offense and was taken to the Racine police station. He was also cited for duty upon striking property and hit and run for leaving the scene of an accident without notifying authorities. Now, he said in an email initially when he responded to this, the Racine County District Attorney said, "I was coming home from a birthday party and had a few drinks. I did initially panic and leave the scene. I take full responsibility for my actions. I am ashamed and embarrassed. I apologize to my family, to the law enforcement community, and to all the citizens of our community. This should not have happened, and I plan to work hard to restore your faith in me." Now, just yesterday, we found out that the Racine County District Attorney has reached a plea agreement in this case already. He's not contesting this. And he has agreed to plead guilty to operating while intoxicated, according to the Associated Press, as well as hit and run, and also an added charge of obstructing an officer. So it looks like he's taken full responsibility in that sense by, you know, I mean, he's come in very quickly. He's apologized to everybody. And, you know, I just wonder about this, and my understanding is he's a good prosecutor. He's, he's a reasonable prosecutor who listens to both sides. So I respect that about him if that's the case. I've never had any personal dealings with him. But, there are a lot of people calling for him to step down from his job. I don't think he needs to step down.
I think he does.
You do?
I absolutely do, yes.
Why?
Well, because... he's a person that stands in a position of making prosecutorial decisions, and while bogged down in the mire, I understand he's getting it over with fairly quickly here, but in terms of, but for the grace of God, there go we all, it's one of those things that is certainly going to draw public attention to every prosecutorial decision that's made from now on, because it will be viewed in the eyes of someone who has, number one, violated the law, which I understand a lot of people do, and some of you people out there speed. I don't. But, there are laws that are broken, and there are consequences for that. I get that. It's certainly, I suppose, appropriate that he rushed in and got a plea deal right away, which, by the way, sounds like none of this is criminal, which it could have been. The
right.
obstructing
right.
part of it could have been criminal.
Sure.
And in fact... that's based on an element of dishonesty here, okay? Because it's not just that he left the scene. It's that initially, and you didn't read this part of the report, but initially he denied being involved in the crash, is my understanding. And that's where the obstructing charge comes from.
Really?
Yes.
Did he?
I heard a report of that. I know it's not in the article that you said, and maybe this is speculation, but it's my understanding that's where that charge is derived. Now, we're talking about a person that is elected, and yes, there is a process whereby that person can be recalled and so forth, but this is a person that stands at the very forefront of making prosecutorial decisions, which are substantive in nature and is supposed to exercise discretion in appropriate
cases. So you would
cases.
Rather not leave that up to the citizens of Racine County to decide that issue? You'd rather just step down?
My personal feeling is that if he, for some reason, believes that he can break this law, be dishonest about it and plead guilty to that charge, as well as something that, you know, we all agree the legislative intent behind drunk driving prosecution is to deter it, not simply punish it, catch it and punish it, but to deter it also. And when a district attorney stands in the position of representing the state, and when someone is facing one of these charges, first of all, how could he, at least in the public's eyes, even if he was capable of doing this on a personal level, but in the public's eyes, how could he separate his personal experience with this in such a way that his decisions would be unquestioned?
Well,
let me
know.
Tell you this.
Wait a
let's
minute.
Say there's a case. Let me just finish my
All
point
right.
here, Mr. Hawk.
Eighth.
Let's just say that there's a case that warrants a reduction in charges, or a case that warrants no prosecution, or whatever the case may be, and that's the correct decision under the law, and that's the way that a proper exercise of discretion would work its way out. Do you know what sort of public outcry there will be if this district attorney shows any leniency? On the other hand, let's say he comes down hard on somebody, and then we have this perception that because he pled, reached a plea deal within a week of the incident, that that's going to set the bar for others.
Well, wait a minute
as to how
now.
Quickly you should go in and waive your rights and not contest anything.
Wait a minute, Attorney O'Bear. We have Brad Schimmel, who is the elected DA of Waukesha County, who is now running for the Attorney General of the state of Wisconsin, who has admitted publicly that he has a drunk driving conviction, admittedly from many, many years ago, but he has one. Do you think that disqualifies him for running for Attorney General?
Well, it doesn't disqualify anybody.
Do you think he ought to step down from the race and not run?
I think it's a factor that should be considered.
Really?
When you have chosen to represent every citizen of this state, and that was a conscious decision that was made somewhere in the course of a political career,
yeah.
He woke up one morning and said, I am going to be the people of Wisconsin.
So we're going to sanitize our politicians so much that they can't even have one blemish on their record anymore, or they lose the public trust. What about former Attorney General Peg Lautenschlager, who had a drunk driving in the middle of while she was the Attorney General? You think she ought to step down?
Well,
or should have stepped down?
She got unappointed as a result of that.
Well, but the point is,
or unelected, I should say.
Yes, unelected.
Yeah.
But the point is that I don't believe that a single incident like this, albeit drunk driving, albeit, you know, serious, certainly, ought to disqualify somebody from their job. In fact,
I didn't say disqualify.
I said
that he has a personal responsibility.
Responsibility
to step down.
In fact, it may make him more sensitive to the issues of which he's prosecuting. Because to me, personal experience, we're all shaped by our personal experiences. We're all shaped by our life experiences. Now, you and I do not have any drunk driving convictions on our record. Okay? We don't. And neither does anybody in our office. But at the same time, if you have somebody, especially in a position of power, who has come up from the ranks. I mean, we have, you know, most of our presidents have admitted.
I know where you're going with this, and that is such a fantastically ridiculous argument.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. Let's say someone's on trial for murder, and the prosecutor says, hey, you know, I know how it is.
No,
kill a few people
I'm
now and then.
I'm not saying murder.
Hey, I'm with you, buddy.
We're talking about a first offense drunk driving, which is a non-criminal offense. By the way, our former presidents, many of them, have admitted to, at least they could have been convicted for committing certain offenses, i.e. involving certain controlled substances, right?
Those which are used as aids for studying in college in particular, maybe,
well,
somewhat?
Cocaine?
Oh, yeah,
would that
there's
be
that.
One of them?
Yeah.
There would be one. I'm not just talking about marijuana.
Oh, I thought you were just talking about marijuana.
But I'm also talking about cocaine. So, and we've had many, many a great president, right, who has committed a crime. Do you think about all of the, or could have committed a crime, you know, if they had actually been
admitted to illegal conduct.
Admitted to illegal conduct. And I don't think that ought to disqualify somebody from this.
All right. Let me just point one other thing out here. And that Wisconsin has achieved a status in our country of being weak on the whole drunk driving issue.
But it's not true.
I know it's not true, but the point is that people from other states, other legislatures, you know, throughout the country, because we are the sole state, and I'm not saying the law should change here, but we're the only state that has first offense drunk driving still considered a non-criminal offense. Now, when we have so many elected officials who are accumulating these drunk driving convictions and are representing not only the people of Wisconsin or the people of that particular county, or in the case of Peg Lautenschlager, the Attorney General's office, but also the entire state's stance in terms of whether or not a public official goes down that road to begin with, so to speak. And it ridicules the state. I think that public officials that are in these types of situations need to realize how significant the nationwide consequences can be. And this is news all over the country. This sort of thing, I don't know how many other states, and I could be wrong on this, but I don't think so, how many other states have elected officials that prosecute drunk driving cases with drunk driving convictions.
Well, let's just be real clear here. Then your issue is that he got caught. Because if you look at all of the people in the United States, how many people in this state have admitted, albeit haven't been arrested, have admitted that they have driven perhaps on the edge, or maybe they were impaired from alcohol? Okay, I would venture to guess, and I believe they've done studies on this, that it is a very large percentage of Wisconsin's population and of the population of the United States.
Well, don't you think it's a problem?
It is a problem. It is a problem. But it shouldn't be something where somebody says, well, if that's the case, I'm not going to run for elected office. Because,
well, why not? Because, I mean, you have to consider your effectiveness as an elected leader, and you have to consider the problems that you're going to bring into the system because of your own shortcomings. And good for this guy that he's taking responsibility. Good for him that he's going to get treatment. Good for him that he's going to do all this other stuff. But he shouldn't be district attorney anymore.
All right. Well, we do have to take a break. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
Back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL. Yes,
sir! Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. This is a story that's a real hot button issue out of the Wisconsin State Journal.
Feeling hot. Feeling hot.
You are. And it's Attorney General candidate and Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Ozan is defending a diversion program for abusive parents, okay? Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Ozan on Tuesday defended a program run by his office that provides counseling and services to some parents charged with abuse for excessively disciplining their children. The program, which currently includes 20 offenders, has been criticized by Ozan's opponents in the race to replace Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen. One of the goals of the diversion program is to reduce the racial disparity in Dane County's criminal justice system. But Ozan said the program is open to parents of all race groups. 9 of the 20 participants are white, 1 is Asian, 10 are African American. Charges against participants who complete the 18-month program are dismissed. He says, "We're looking to make sure that we protect all kids with a program that addresses the incident and protects them in the future by giving the parents new parenting tools that are nonviolent. While spanking and other forms of corporal punishment have declined significantly in recent decades, physical discipline remains acceptable in some cultures," he said. Or actually, that's according to a 6-page memo outlining the program. It says, "One goal of the program is to reduce the number of minority parents prosecuted for child abuse for instances of excessive discipline and to provide quick and, quote, culturally sensitive, end quote, intervention in those cases." Now, he's facing a lot of pushback for this because he is talking about how it's culturally sensitive. And in essence, what he's saying is that certain cultures accept corporal punishment more than other cultures do. And particularly, he's talking about the African-American culture. And so that hits on, that's a really racial, that's sort of a racially sensitive issue, because it sounds like what he's saying is that, you know, it's okay.
Black people need more help in this.
Need more help in this area than white people do. I mean, if you boil it down to that, that's sort of sounds like what he's saying.
Well, let me just slow you down for a second here, Attorney Hoff. Did you ever get spanked as a child?
Yes.
I did too.
Yes, I did.
And I'm glad I did.
Because you are.
Because I was misbehaving. I needed to be corrected, and I was. And it wasn't done in a way where I feared my parents because they're outrageously violent people or anything like that. It's just that when I did something really inappropriate, there was the risk that I would be spanked. And frankly, it didn't traumatize me to the point where I have nightmares about it, and I don't have post-traumatic stress disorder, at least not from that. And, I don't hate my parents as a result of it. In fact, I love my parents very much, and I never saw any incident in my childhood as being something that I didn't deserve, a punishment that I didn't deserve. Now, I know I grew up in the, late 60s, early 70s, don't want to date myself, but I guess I just did. And I know that sort of thing was, our culture was a little different in the sense that that's something that had been sort of a child-rearing tradition, and it has been for thousands of years, by the way. And over the years, we've become, in my mind, perhaps a little oversensitive to this issue, because now the timeout theory, which is a good one, and the idea of, okay, you're going to have an 8-minute break from your video game because you broke mom's favorite vase or whatever.
We're going to take away your smartphone.
We're going to take away your smartphone. You're going to have to tweeter on the computer instead of with your handheld thing or whatever. I don't even know how that stuff works.
Tweeter.
Isn't that what it is?
That's interesting.
No,
tweet.
Okay.
Tweet.
Tweeting. Yeah. Whatever. But the point is that is, it's part of parenting. In fact, our law does allow for corporal punishment.
Reasonable
corporal punishment. And that's part of the problem is that, this is one of those areas of the law that there's this gray area, and somebody else with their own morals and their own ideas and their own way of raising a child has their own judgment as to what's appropriate. Now, I think that this is a step in the right direction in the sense that we need more programs like this. And the Dane County DA should be lauded for the fact that he's trying to be creative in a sense that if we had more ways to educate people and provide them with resources and that sort of thing, particularly, I think, as it relates to substance abuse problems.
But here's the issue, though. The problem is he's saying that this is a culturally sensitive program.
Maybe he just really doesn't want to be elected as the Attorney General.
This would be a good way to do it.
Do you remember the movie The Producers, where they put together a play that is sure to fail?
Sure.
I mean, maybe there's some sort of this is sort of like throwing in the towel politically.
You can't lump a quote-unquote culture in with it. I mean,
of course not. And I think it's odd. I mean, I know that there's some statistical data that he cites that supports this proposition, but how do you implement a program that tries to level that playing field?
Here's the bottom line with this, and I mean, he's taking a lot of heat for this, but you're right. When it comes to parental discipline, there used to be this understanding that people would be able to discipline, i.e. spank their children. Now, I don't think that that's the case so much anymore, because I think that there have been, a lot of the baby boomers who sort of experienced that with many parents in that generation.
Yeah.
I think we've come to understand largely as a society that spanking or hitting certainly doesn't necessarily change behavior in a positive way.
Right, because as we've seen, what it can do is it makes your kid turn into a hippie and go to Woodstock and protest the war and smoke marijuana, right? Isn't that what happens?
No, that's not what I'm saying. But aren't there, as we evolve as a society, aren't there better parenting tactics that we learn? Isn't there something that we learn
but I have to believe that have we evolved so quickly in the past 15 or 20 years that we've taken such a sea change, step away from the way that parents have disciplined children for ever, since the history of man, it just bothers me because we come up with ideas, and I do believe in creativity. I like the idea. I like the gist of this program. I like the fact that we should do something to give people an incentive to avoid a conviction. It's just that, think about it, Casey. What does this program involve? You go to a class and they say, hey, don't hit your kids. And the person says, yep, I'm not going to hit my kids. Okay, you get a gold star and a certificate and a handshake and everything else. So remember, don't hit your kids. Oh, I won't. And then it just goes away. I mean, isn't this one of those programs that it's even easier to pay lip service to what they're, to the head nodding movement than it would be, say, for something that is really at the root of some of our economic and social problems?
But I think that's selling the program short. I mean, really, my understanding of this program, when you have counseling and services, you're putting somebody through a position where they have to complete that counseling. It's not just – and people often poo-poo rehabilitation and counseling and things like that as somehow lenient. I don't view it as lenient because it's better than, in many situations, incarcerating somebody, because by incarcerating somebody, oftentimes you just harden the person. You don't necessarily get to an understanding as to how they can correct the behavior so that this doesn't happen again, because ultimately that's what we're trying to get to, is correcting the behavior and stopping somebody from going too far. As you point out, we already have in Wisconsin, you can reasonably discipline your child in terms of corporal punishment. We won't get into the specifics of that today, but you can reasonably do it. But you can't beat your kid. And if you have something, if you have somebody who does that and they are under this program, it's too much, and you're under this program where they have to be there for a certain period of time, and they have to complete this. That's a good thing.
But again, doesn't this raise the problem that, and this is what I think stands out to me as a societal issue, that is just another example of perhaps our laws overreacting to a trend in society. And what I mean by that is that we have this idea in our minds, and it's in this fantasy world, that when a father or mother is thinking this child needs discipline, and then they're going to gauge somewhere on that spectrum of how hard the spanking is going to be, they're supposed to consider, well, let's see, if I apply so many pounds of force per square inch, it's going to be a felony if I am too vigorous in my spanking. On the other hand, it might be an ordinance file. And hey, wait a minute, maybe I could get one of these diversion programs, and you know, little Johnny who stole money out of the cookie jar, I'm going to spank him, you know, just enough to get into one of these diversion programs. Obviously, it doesn't work that way. And I don't think that, a parent that abuses a child because of anger or passion or hatred, there are laws that specifically address that type of situation. But here's the problem. The laws don't deter parents. And if they do deter parents from administering corporal punishment in an appropriate situation, that's where I think our laws, and there are many cases, we have seen many cases where a child is spanked, and then depending upon what that seven-year-old says in school the next day about how hard he got spanked, we now have a felony prosecution against that parent,
right,
for doing something based upon the seven-year-old who did something wrong to begin with and got punished for it and now feels bad about it. And naturally, like any seven-year-old would, feels angry at the parents. But, and now the seven-year-old drives the train.
But perhaps this program that he has implemented is bringing more awareness to that issue. And perhaps it will help to curb some of this stuff and, you know, make people more aware that you don't necessarily charge in every case, because you have to, you don't charge in every case. You have to look at the unique facts and circumstances of this case. And I think this program is a step in the right direction to say, okay, we're going to hold people who do this too much accountable. But at the same time, we're also going to educate the public on this. All right, we got to take a break. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear.
All right, Kirk.
I think. Yeah, I am.
You are. You still are. Oscar Pistorius, this trial has been going on. And I don't know. I mean, I've been following this. I know you've been following this.
I have.
It's really amazing because, and of course, if you don't know, Oscar Pistorius, of course, is on trial for the
murder
of his, I think it was
girlfriend,
Reva Steenkamp. And the whole issue is whether it was a mistake when he shot through the bathroom door, ended up killing her because he thought an intruder was there, or whether it was an intentional homicide. And I just saw this prosecution, and and Oscar Pistorius was on the stand. Okay, and it's just such so different than
that's the thing that's fascinating about it is the differences between our system and theirs. You know, there's one judge that with the two advisors,
two assessors,
that sort of whisper in her ear and say, "Oh, don't want to look
at
that."
And they say, "My lady," I think that's what they say when they address the judge, the female judge. And so the prosecutor has been so ruthless with Oscar Pistorius, and I got to tell you, I think this has been a mistake. And here's what I mean by this. He has called him a liar. He said, "You're a liar," which would not be permitted, at least in any courtroom that I know of, in terms of saying you're a liar on cross-examination and pointing.
Well, you can ask a defendant if they have lied.
Well, sure, but what he's doing is he's arguing with him.
Yeah.
He's not cross-examining him. He's arguing with him. And he's getting so brutal while Oscar Pistorius is sitting there crying. And some people believe that's genuine emotion. Others believe it's not because he's sorry he got caught. Others say, well, okay, it is genuine because it was his girlfriend. Whatever the case may be, through all of this crying, which, by the way, they had to stop the trial because he was crying so much. This prosecutor, I think, is just going overboard. Now, there's a time to be brutal, and you and I know that in courtrooms, sometimes you have to get very aggressive.
Our system depends upon it.
It depends upon
part of the philosophy that in a tug of war, both sides have to pull
as hard as they can. Aggressiveness doesn't necessarily mean, in many cases, I don't think it means shouting and yelling. If you want to convince, in this case, a judge. In the United States, oftentimes a jury, to convince them by being so, if they perceive you as being just mean to the person who's on the witness stand, unless they hate that person on the witness stand, which oftentimes they don't, that's, I think, a bad strategy in this situation.
Well, yeah, because the finder of fact will perceive that the prosecutor is overreaching or trying to simply make the person look bad. You know, I know that you have an opinion with regard to whether Oscar was believable or not on the stand, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit.
Sure.
Because I think he totally wasn't.
Oh, really?
And I'll tell you why. You know, I understand that it was an emotional event. I understand that he, and if we are to believe him, that his girlfriend died and so forth. But, you know, it's been a long time leading up to this trial. And I understand that there will be some emotion. I don't expect anybody to be emotionless in this process. But as you hear the words, and as you hear the stuttering, and as you hear the sobbing, and as you hear the difficulty in getting the words out, it sounded like an act to me. And I know we're not supposed to, you know, judge the... Well, we're going to get into this later in the show about how you can tell if someone's lying.
Right.
You know, from nonverbal cues and things like that. But, you know, part of credibility with any witness's testimony, whether they're on trial or not, is your sense of whether they are or aren't telling the truth. And his description of the events and just the... It seemed that he was over-emoting. And, you know, like an attempt to make somebody feel sorry for him. That's what it seemed like. It seemed like there was, you know, a conscious choice to, in terms of the timing of the sobs, the timing of when he had to, you know, blow his nose, the timing of when he barfed all over the place in the courtroom. I mean, I'm not saying that was a voluntary,
action. How do you make yourself throw up?
I don't know, but you know, it's
here's the thing about it. And maybe that's true. And, you know, everybody has different perceptions of that. And that's the interesting thing about this case is that depending upon your perception of when he paused and when he cried and all of that, you could say on the one hand you think he's lying. On the other hand, you could say that you think he's being honest.
Well, yeah, but you know what doesn't make sense to me? He's portraying himself as this weak little man that didn't know what to do, and he's like a scared little rabbit in the woods, and he didn't know what, he was so afraid that someone was breaking into his house, he just had to start firing through the bathroom door. That's ridiculous.
Well, he doesn't have two legs.
I know that.
I mean, really?
But
and he didn't have his legs.
You hear noises in your bathroom, and you shoot? Yeah, I mean, how ridiculous. And a lot of the evidence that came out is that, well, first of all, she was afraid of him and that he got violent and these sorts of things. And he has a very aggressive type personality, which is totally inconsistent with the blubbering idiot that was on the stand.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You and I sit here and we live in Sheboygan, right?
Okay. Yes, we do.
Yes, we do live in Sheboygan.
I will agree with that.
Yeah. He lives in South Africa, and particularly in an area in South Africa, in a neighborhood that has a high
incidence
of crime. And we know, by the way, he doesn't live in this city, but Johannesburg has one of the highest crime rates in the world. So we don't live in an area like he lives in. And Sheboygan has crime. That's true. You and I are criminal defense lawyers. But if you're sitting in a situation like that, you have to take that into consideration.
I understand that he didn't have his legs on when this happened, but
right.
But how hard would it have been to say, "Who's in there?" And don't you think she would have said, "It's me, honey," or something like that?
Well,
you know?
I suppose in Kirkobear Land, where you have this.
Oh, yeah, in my land, people don't go shooting each other.
No, in your land, where everything is just. Did you see, by the way, did you see in the news the other day? And I don't mean to divert from this, but there was an elderly couple. I think it was in Ohio. And there was a man who came to the door, and he had some type of weapon. It was either a knife or a gun. The old lady answers the door. I think she had to be about 90 years old. And the old man was there. And at least in the interview, he was wearing his World War II hat. He was a World War II veteran. This guy comes in and he says he wants their money. And this old man goes over to try to grab a cane or something and try to beat him. You don't have time in these situations to react and to analyze every situation in an ideal light from Monday morning quarterbacking. If he was behind that door, and if he thought an intruder was behind that door and had a weapon, I'm not saying what he did was right. Certainly, it was a mistake, at the very least, and it could have been an intentional homicide.
Well, and I know this is in a different country where, you know, our constitutional principles are not really an issue at all. But, you know, I just have to point out once again that if there hadn't been a handgun in this scenario, there would be one less dead person in the scenario. You know, I mean, isn't that a point that's really kind of irrefutable?
Yes, but you always do this. There's also.
Well, how can I resist?
I can take an anecdote from somebody who defended themselves with a weapon, and I can say it's a good thing there was a weapon in that situation because this guy shot the bad guy. And he defended himself. So we can always take anecdotes like
that. I'd so much rather have the police shoot the bad guy. And really, I would.
But that's not the real world. Because if you're in your home, if somebody comes into Kirkobear's home, and you don't have time to call the police in many situations, what are you going to do?
Well, I'm not going to shoot people that walk into my home unless I know who they are and I know that there's a real threat. If someone's in my bathroom and I hear a noise in the bathroom, and the thing that set him off was that he heard the toilet seat shut loudly. I mean, that's something that happens in bathrooms. At least my experience is that occasionally the toilet seat is shut with enough force that it makes a sound.
Yes,
you know,
that's true.
So does that mean that, you know, the person is greeted with a hail of gunfire through the door?
No, but he his story is obviously that he thought that there was an intruder. Okay.
Through the window.
The prosecution has been playing this video of Mr. Pistorius shooting at a watermelon at a gun range.
Mm-hmm.
They played that video for the judge. All right. Now, how in God's name that is relevant to anything in this case? Because he was at a gun range at some other time?
Yeah, I'm not really sure how
other
that is
incident?
Relevant. I mean, I'll agree with you on that.
Yeah. And I mean, but you see what
like,
they're doing.
As if he just likes to shoot whatever.
He just
in
likes
front
to shoot whatever.
He just shoots.
Watermelon, head,
shoot
it
first,
doesn't matter.
Questions later.
Shoot first, questions later. Right. So I suppose if they're trying to say he's reckless, that's one way of trying to prove it. On the other hand,
well, I said this on an earlier show. You know, I don't think there's any dispute that Pistorius is guilty of a crime here. It's just a matter of whether or not it was intentional. Because, you know, regardless, if this were under American law and if it happened exactly the way that he says, it's still a crime. Because
it's a negligent homicide.
It's a negligent or reckless homicide because it's just plain irresponsible to shoot through a closed door, not knowing who's on the other side, even if you suspect that it's a burglar or something like that.
Yeah.
In fact, if it's in one of those states where you don't necessarily have the affirmative defense of protecting your home or property, and it varies from state to state, of course, you don't necessarily have the right to kill somebody just because they've entered your home.
Right.
In all jurisdictions.
Right.
That does apply in some. Well, but you have to reasonably believe the person is there to commit a crime, and that the person is there unlawfully, and that it's a person that is not your girlfriend.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I just, but it'll be interesting to see how the emotion plays out, because I know that this isn't a jury, this is a judge and two assessors in South Africa. But I think if most people are being honest, and judges, many will admit this, and they should, they don't just call balls and strikes. They are also affected by emotion. And maybe they're not supposed to be affected by emotion, but they're human beings, and they are. And of course, we have more Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey coming up right here on 1330 WHBL.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. You know, Casey, I noticed this morning that there was a little bit too much blood in my caffeine stream, so I fixed that problem. I had some of the Jet Fuel coffee that they serve here at the studio.
Oh, good for
you. It's actually called Jet Fuel.
Yes.
That's the name of it. Have you seen this?
I have not.
It's a wonderful thing.
That is wonderful. Well, you're always revved up, so we know how you get.
The last segment's always the one where my head's spinning, you know.
That's right. Well, we've got a story from the news. Want to spot a liar? Here's what the psychologists tell us. Many people wander through a world littered with white lies, the social niceties freshening up the atmosphere of necessary interaction. Things like love those earrings. That's one of the examples that they use. But they say that those...
I love your earrings that you're wearing today.
Oh, thank you. I've got wonderful earrings. Those who indulge in sugar-coated sentiments, though, may be paying an invisible price, psychologists say. Suspicious that others are guilty of the same less-than-perfectly honest behavior, they may be robbing themselves of the pleasure of believing a simple compliment bestowed for no reason. That is a total something that would come from a psychologist, right?
Yeah, right.
That's just... But it's probably true.
So but haven't you ever met somebody who's too honest and they to their own detriment?
Yeah. Oh,
like,
yes.
Like, where did you get those horrible earrings?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's wonderful. So you have compulsive or pathological liars, which we don't like, right? I mean, that's society
right.
Doesn't like that. And then you have the little white lies, like, oh, you're looking very nice tonight. Or when, in fact, you may be thinking the person doesn't look nice tonight.
Right, right.
Or you look good in that dress or that pair of
right,
jeans
right, right,
or whatever.
Right. These jeans make me look fat? You know, that kind of thing.
No, of course not. So there's also, they've done studies on eye movements. And you've heard the old adage that if a person looks up to the right when they're visualizing some sort of imagined event, they're lying. But if they look up to the left... They're telling the truth.
Well, sounds like nonsense to me.
Yes, and that's really been debunked by...
Doesn't it matter, you know, sort of like what's in your field of vision to the right or the left? No,
right.
No, what I've heard, and this is what I was trained when I was back in prosecutor school, and bear in mind, this was a long time ago. Again, not dating myself, but this was in the early 90s. Oh, I just did it again.
Oh, geez.
But anyway, when I used to train police officers on visual cues, when you're detecting little things that come out in the process of nonverbal communication. And like most people that went through college, I had to take, I'm not sure I enjoyed them, but a lot of classes on communication and that sort of thing. And I have a degree in psychology, so there's a lot of that stuff too.
Yeah.
But basically, the philosophy is that when someone is telling the truth, there is an involuntary tendency to make eye contact because we believe what we're saying. Conversely, when one is telling a lie, there's this theory that you have to keep the lie straight in your head in order to avoid visual distractions for, you know, what we call cooperative visual cues. Like when, like right now, I'm saying this, I'm moving my hand, you're nodding your head. That's because you're participating in the conversation with me, and we're working together for an understanding.
That's right.
And we do this because you signal that you understand what the person's saying, you signal that you're interested in what they're saying. But if, on the other hand, I don't make that eye contact with you, and I'm saying something that's critical to the point of the story, like you ask me, did I shoot through the door with the intent to kill my girlfriend? And I look up to the left and I say, well, hold on a second. You know, our personal human interaction with other people tells us that that's not a genuine response, because the person can't be distracted by those nonverbal cues, and they have to keep rehearsing the story and the facts in their head. So closing one's eyes, looking up, looking down, or diverting the discussion so the person can have more time to think. You know, these are all things that, by the way, are not really scientifically based, and it's more like a lot of ideas about how you can. So, and a lot of these right. are interrogation techniques, by the way, so I should back up a second and explain that. A lot of interrogation techniques are not based in science at all. They're based on ways in which an interrogator can utilize this pseudoscience as a way to put more pressure on a person. So let's say I'm interrogating you about something, like, did you steal money from the office coffee fund? And I see you looking down as you're telling me your explanation. Well, what I'm supposed to do is say, well, Mr. Hoff, I know that you're lying. Look, you're looking down. I can see that you're doing that. I've been trained in this. I went to a class. Captain O'Bear in the military taught me that if you're looking down, then that's something that you can confront the person with and say, you're not looking me in the eye. I can tell that you didn't do this. Then the person's caught off guard. Then they start changing their story. Then they break down and they confess.
Right.
And so on. You know where it goes from there.
Right. Absolutely. And they, one of the things, though, that they did find was that skin temperature can be an indicator as to whether somebody is lying or not. In other words, the warmer the skin temperature, the more likely they are to lie. Now that's
to have a fever.
That's right, or to have a fever. That's in general. But then blinking was another thing. A lot of people believe that if you blink a lot, then you are lying. Researchers found the opposite tendency would be true. That actually, if you're blinking a lot, you're not. If you're never blinking, then that's more of an indicator that you're being deceptive. But again, all of these things are generalizations. People react in different ways.
Well, and under something that we go through a lot, because, you know, although polygraph testing is not admissible in courts, it's oftentimes utilized in criminal investigations.
Right.
We know that from TV. We know that from personal experience. But, you know, the premise behind polygraph testing is that when one lies, there's an involuntary physiological response that results in even a very minor amount of respiratory change, sweat response,
yes.
and also the verbal response. And you know, sure. they have this somewhat new technology. It's not brand new. It's been around for about 10 years. But this voice stress analyzer, which is really a computer program that detects differences. The thing that's so hard to incorporate into that as a science, and one reason why I think at least the state of Wisconsin acknowledges that this just isn't firmly rooted in science well enough to have it be reliable in court, is the fact that being accused of something terrible elicits a response regardless of whether you've committed the crime or not.
Right.
And the theory that you can calmly and dispassionately deny committing a crime, although here I was just talking about how Oscar Pistorius was a little crybaby on the stand. I didn't mean to say it that way, because I'm sure, you know, it would be emotional for anybody, and I'll correct myself slightly by saying that, you know, I expected some emotion. It's just that the gut feeling you get is...
You thought it was too much.
I thought it was too much, and it seemed deliberate. But going back to this polygraph issue, it's very hard to discern the stress that one feels from being accused of a serious crime versus the stress that one feels because they've committed that crime.
Right.
It's very difficult to discern.
Right.
Now, people that have certifications in this area and have training in administering these types of tests will tell you that the machine can detect differences. But again, oftentimes what we see is that a test administered in accordance with the correct method by a properly trained person can still be inconclusive, even when the person's telling the truth or even when the person's lying.
Well, and we rely on juries. We rely on juries to and judges to figure that out, to find out exactly, you know, whether somebody's lying and when they're lying and how that whole thing is going about. And it's very difficult, as you say, to discern that. Mm. So it's one of these situations where, you know, the science is, even if you're a psychologist, you can't tell 100%. And we don't want people going into courtrooms saying you're lying or
well, I can tell,
you
know, that,
I can tell that this person is a human lie detector,
yeah.
Which is why juries are supposed to be finders of fact.
Yeah.
But they also can assess the credibility of witnesses.
That's what's ironic about it is that we can't have somebody get on the stand and say, I believe this person. You know, because that's the issue the jury has to decide. But at the same time, we do expect the jury to be human lie detectors, right?
Right.
There's that jury instruction that every jury gets is that you are the judges of credibility. Consider all of these things, the witnesses' demeanor on the stand, whether they have a motive to lie, all these types of things. And really, that's the essence of jury trials. And that's what jury trials come down to, is deciding who's telling the truth about a particular situation. So I say this all the time. I'm going to say it again because I know I sound like a broken record. And if there was something I could do about it, I would. But I can't because I'm just me. But, you know, it seems so imprecise and unscientific and, in fact, arbitrary that this is how a modern civilization with all of our technology and all of our advancements in science, and we're working towards either the elimination or effective treatment of cancer. We have ways of dealing with epidemics. We have ways of dealing with other social problems. Yet we still put somebody on the witness stand and let 12 people analyze with their gut feelings whether this witness is telling the truth or not, and people's lives are determined by that.
Right, but I think a jury system is better.
Well, it's better,
generally speaking, because you have a system, and by the way, this is a system that really is in many ways the envy of the world. I mean, there are a lot of, certainly as you and I talk about, in many situations there are a lot of faults and ways that we can improve our justice system. And we talk about them all the time, you know, over-incarceration, mass incarceration, those types of things, people who are sitting in prison who are innocent, those are huge issues. But when it comes to the actual jury system itself, we do trust 12 citizens to, in most cases, make the correct decision about these types of
things. And I think that's the problem with countries, cultures, civilizations that don't have jury systems is they don't trust their citizens.
Right.
And, you know, the essence of why that's important. And there's another thing about this is that it's a check on the system because the prosecutor has to consider what a person that is not standing in their shoes would perceive. And is this something that a jury is going to view favorably or not? And that's something that's good for our system because it keeps the prosecutor, and for that matter, the defense lawyer, from determining an outcome based on their own subjective.
That's right. All right. We have to end the show for today. Thanks for listening. This has been another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL.